some members of the board. Down at that end of the table is Peter Pumphrey from Chalfont. Next to me is Kimberly Cox from Hellendale. On the other side of our executive officer is Keith Dias from Rosamond, and at the far end is Don Jardine from Markleyville. Eric Sandell from Truckee was unable to join us. And did I introduce myself? I'm Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee, and I'm the chair. Our executive officer is Patty Kuyumjin. Ms. Kuyumjin, could you please introduce the staff?
Thank you, Dr. Horn. Be happy to. Good evening, everyone. To my left, I have Sue Genera, our board clerk, and Ken Niemeyer, our staff counsel, and Gita Kapai from our state board, who will be helping us this evening. I have Lori Kemper, our assistant executive officer from our Tahoe office, Michael Plasiak, our division manager from our Victorville office. We have Laura Drabent from our state board. And I would like to also welcome Sean McCarthy from our drinking water division, newly moved over from the Department of Public Health as part of the State Water Board. So welcome. Richard Booth is in the audience from our Tahoe office. Lisa Durnbach from our Tahoe office. And holding next to her, Thomas Brown is in our audience. And Patrice Copeland as well. And Linda Stone from our Tahoe office, I believe, is here as well. Or she may have.
Yep,
there she is. So I thank you, everyone.
Okay, as I mentioned, we're going to do things differently this evening. I'm coming out from behind the table. Beware, beware. And I'm going to ask all my fellow board members to join the audience for this next part of the evening. As I mentioned, so I'm going to leave this one off and continue to hold this one. Is that
perfect?
Okay. For this portion of the evening, we have several items, as I mentioned, having to do with PG&E and Hinckley. The first one is a workshop having to do with the development of a cleanup and abatement order. Then there will be a status report. After that, there is a public forum. Following that, there's a housekeeping item having to do with removing some orders for PG&E that have become outdated. For item two, we are trying to do work in item two, this workshop portion, having to do with developing the a cleanup and abatement order. And so we really encourage your input. We want your comments during item two to stay focused on the material of item two. So if you want to talk to us about the waste pit, about destruction of homes, about stray dogs, about dying trees, or anything else, we want to hear your comments, but we hope you will hold those types of comments until we get to the public forum, which is agenda item number four. So again, in item two, we're trying to get input to the board to help us frame the next portion of the cleanup, and we want your comments to be focused on and questions related to that. So after my introduction, then Gita Kapai will go over the ground rules for this evening. Lori Kemper will make a staff presentation, and the bulk of item two will be presentation by PG&E from Kevin Sullivan about their model. Gita Kapai will then facilitate the discussion, and everyone can participate in that. And again, we hope your comments will stay focused on the topic of the potential cleanup and abatement order in the PG&E model. Following all of our discussion, the staff will try to summarize your comments, and then the board will discuss and provide feedback to the staff on how to go forward on a cleanup and abatement order. But I just want to set the context for this discussion, and that is just to have us all think a little bit about the progress we've been making over the last 6 years. In 2008, the board issued a cleanup and abatement order to PG&E that required PG&E to contain the chromium plume, to evaluate cleanup options, to clean up the groundwater, and as part of that cleanup and abatement order, we set background levels of chromium 6. The next slide shows that in 2008, the board issued another cleanup and abatement order that required PG&E to monitor domestic wells and to provide water to households. Then in 2008, the board fined PG&E $3.6 million for failing, for violations related to the 2008 cleanup and abatement order. So for failure to contain the plume. And half of that money was used to provide clean water to Hinckley School, which was open at the time. So I just want to stress that that 2008 cleanup and abatement order is still in effect, so that the board retains authority to take enforcement should there be any other violations to that cleanup and abatement order that were not covered in that 2012 settlement. And in addition, the board has issued 23 other orders that have required PG&E to investigate certain questions or to provide the water board with technical information. The board has taken other actions in the past 6 years. The community, you have told us that you didn't trust the original background chromium 6 study, and so we asked that that study be peer-reviewed. The scientists found that that study was inadequate, and as a result, we are undertaking another background study with Dr. Izbicki from USGS, and we expect the results in 2020. The board certified the final environmental impact report in 2013, and the board ordered PG&E to investigate byproducts from the uranium byproducts from the agricultural treatment units and the manganese byproducts from the in-situ treatment units. And as part of the first phase of the final cleanup plan, we issued a new permit to PG&E earlier this year to expand the agricultural treatment units. Now, I know that it feels like it's taking a long time to deal with this issue, and that people are feeling frustrated with how long it is taking. There are a lot of reasons for that. Part of it is that it's a very difficult issue and it's very technical. Part of it is that the board has been listening carefully to what the community has to say. We have heard you when you said you didn't trust the original background levels. We have asked for a new study to be done as a result of the community's input. Nonetheless, we are not waiting for those results, and we are continuing to ask PG&E to move forward on cleaning up this plume. And we are trying to do that in a way that is cautious, so that we are approving portions of the plan as we feel that there is certainty about those portions of the plan. And where there are uncertainties about the plan, we are asking for further research to try to remove those uncertainties before we approve other components of the plan. So the question to keep in mind as we go through item two is, how should the Water Board structure a new cleanup order that will provide more specificity, more interim targets for PG&E to meet than we have currently under the 2008 cleanup and abatement order? So this is incorporating information that was developed for the final environmental impact report and subsequent to that. So how should we structure a cleanup and abatement order to hold PG&E accountable and to allow adjustments to improve cleanup? And with that, I will turn the meeting over to Gita Kapai to facilitate and provide the ground rules.
Thank you, Dr. Horn. So my job tonight is to facilitate the discussion, to make sure everyone has a voice. I want to make sure that we all use common courtesy. Please don't interrupt another speaker. Listen to each other and respect all views. You may not agree with what someone says, but everyone has a voice. Please turn off your cell phones. If you must take a call, please do so outside of the meeting room. And we want to give everyone the opportunity to participate. I don't think there's a huge crowd here today, but time limits may be imposed where needed. I want to make sure that everyone has that opportunity to speak. I will not take questions that are yelled out from the audience, or even if you put up your hand. I ask that everyone please fill out a card. During some of the technical presentation, when Kevin Sullivan is doing his technical presentation, I ask that perhaps you fill out a 5x7 card and write down some of the questions that come up at the end of his presentation, and we'll take those questions so that we make sure that everyone understands and we clarify anything that is not clear. Other than that, I will just facilitate as needed. So.
All right.
Don't worry.
I'm just going to give a brief overview of what we're doing and why we're doing it tonight. So, as Amy mentioned, we're here tonight to work on hearing about one part of a new cleanup and abatement order that staff will be producing at the end of this year. So, to have more specificity about interim cleanup measures and progress, and to basically move forward in the next few years based on the cleanup work that's underway today. The purpose tonight's workshop is focused on cleanup timeframes and how fast is the cleanup occurring and how fast can we predict it to occur in the future. We've actually required PG&E to update their computer modeling that they did a few years ago based on new information that they've been collecting while cleanup has been taking place over the last few years. So tonight is really educating all of us on these predictive computer tools and also seeing actual data here in the Hinckley area in terms of what kind of cleanup has been occurring. So it is going to be technical, and we do encourage people to ask questions because the main purpose is for people to leave the room with some greater understanding about the cleanup that's occurring and that's planned and predictions for the future. The other thing we're looking for specifically is input on how best to structure this new order and ways to measure progress, and that can be as creative as you want to be. So we're looking for those ideas. The other thing I want to point out is that in Kevin's presentation, and if you looked at his slides that we sent out last week and we described in our agenda packet, earlier this summer in May or June, we requested that PG&E update their computer modeling that they had done as part of the feasibility study that was conducted in the 2008, 9, 10, 11 kind of time frame. So the feasibility study was used to develop the environmental impact report, and specifically we asked PG&E to update the model as it related to alternative 4C2, which was one of the scenarios in the EIR that described the use of IRZs, the ethanol injection, as well as agricultural treatment. And it laid out a conceptual plan for how many treatment units would be in place. We asked that they update that based on information today and based on the fact that things have been occurring over the last 3 or 4 years in terms of treatment and extraction. We also asked that they do more of a current reality. In other words, what's on the ground today? Some of that differs from what was described in the environmental impact report. And as PG&E has shared with the community, they're planning new agricultural units closer to the compressor station. And some of that was maybe described in the EIR, but the idea was to really take what we know today is being operated, what's planned for the next year, because PG&E has a number of plans to expand agricultural treatment and ethanol injections over the next 12 months. There are a number of other things that PG&E may do in the future that are described in the EIR, and many of those things are north of Thompson Road, and they involve areas where desert tortoise habitat is a greater risk, and it requires permitting by California Department of Fish and Wildlife and U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and there is some uncertainty about those permits and the timing. It's probably at least 3 years away. So what we really asked PG&E to do was to take what we know is in the ground and operating today and what we know is going to be operating within the next year and predict that out to the future. So the modeling scenarios that Kevin is going to present tonight are in response to our specific request we made of PG&E this spring. The third, so there's two scenarios related to the current reality, and one they're different because of changes to the computer model. And Kevin will talk more about that, but they're the same scenario in terms of what's on the ground. It's just that when you develop a model, you're predicting what's going on underground, so they use different coefficients or numbers in the computer model. So you'll hear more detail, but I wanted to kind of let you introduce you to why he's going to present three options to you, or three scenarios. And then lastly, again, we are wanting to come up with some ways. We want to use these models and these predictions, these estimates, to help us frame what we can expect in the future, and we want to look for ways to track cleanup progress that is meaningful to the community and to the board, and that we can all understand, that we can be clear about. So that if it's every year or every 2 years, that we're on track, we're getting where we want to go, you know, if we're headed down this path over the next 10 or more years. So that's part of what we're looking for. We also understand, and as PG&E does more cleanup and we see what actually is occurring on the ground, we see that we don't always know exactly how the plume is going to behave. And sometimes we think cleanup is occurring in an area, and it may be, and then there may be other areas where increases in chrome are occurring that we don't always understand. And so we want this new order to somehow be able to acknowledge that uncertainty and provide some flexibility for all of us to make the best decisions moving forward related to improving the ability to clean up the pollutants out of the groundwater. So that's another thing that we traditionally have just had very specific requirements, and it sometimes is difficult to change them. We're looking for ways to word those kinds of expectations in a way that allows all of us to agree to changes if we want to move extraction systems or build new treatment units in different areas. So that's the other challenge I put out to all of you. And then just in terms of how does the Water Board develop a cleanup and abatement order, and what are the elements, I just want to assure everyone that, again, tonight we are just focused on how fast is the cleanup occurring, how is it being measured, how can we track it in the future, how can we improve it or hasten, speed up the cleanup. That's tonight's focus. But the actual order will have a number of elements. So the order always has findings that lay out the history and the purpose of the order, and we lay out the legal authorities. We make the CEQA finding using the environmental impact report the board already certified, and that'll be laid out up front. And then in the order section, where we actually lay out the requirements for PG&E, we know we're looking to have some interim cleanup requirements so that in a 4-year time frame or a 5-year time frame, we can track whether they're in compliance with the cleanup. We are also going to set out specific monitoring requirements, and many of these things we've already got in other orders, and the goal behind this new order is to try to consolidate a number of the existing orders that are currently active on PG&E. So next month in November, we're going to be talking, not next month, 2 months from now, we're going to be talking about the overall monitoring program and how that should move forward into the future. In addition to that, on November, we're also going to be talking about plume control requirements. So currently, PG&E is under orders to maintain hydraulic capture, which means they can't allow the plume to move past Thompson Road, the core contamination area. And as the plume gets cleaned up south of Thompson, we want to be able to move that line south. So we're going to be talking in greater detail about that in November. And then, again, we're going to have specific monitoring requirements for both the monitoring wells and domestic wells. We also want to incorporate triggers for contingency or corrective action plans. So this is as we do adjust and we're seeing cleanup progress, if we see something pop back up somewhere, maybe they turn one pump off to turn on a new pump and then we see chromium coming back, we want to have a plan up front about what will happen. And some of this you've heard about in our agricultural treatment permit that we adopted in April, where PG&E will continue to monitor domestic wells, and if they see chromium increasing, that they will take certain actions to provide replacement water or increase pumping or change their method of treatment and extraction. And then the order will also have specific requirements about replacement water. So again, if those triggers, certain triggers are, if a well gets affected, PG&E would be required to provide replacement water. And then the order, we also hope to include the requirement to continue having independent technical advice available for the community. And this is just this isn't everything that will be in that order, but these are some of the main things. And in the board packet that's on our website, and we have a copy in the back of the room, there is a table that was produced by staff with the help of a number of people to try to catalog all of the orders that we have issued to PG&E. Some of those we have rescinded and no longer in effect. Some are in effect, and we are trying to use that catalog as kind of an auditing tool to make sure that we don't lose track of anything that we required PG&E to do in the past, and if it's still important that they do it, we want to include it in this new order. So, but some of the requirements are somewhat overlapping or maybe duplicative now, especially if it's related to monitoring, because we kind of added things on as we went, and so we wanted to try to wrap that all up into an order, and that's our goal for this winter. Here's our timeline. So tonight we're having a workshop on cleanup timeframes. November, again, we're going to focus on monitoring and what needs to be monitored going into the future, and the plume control requirements about how to maintain capture and to ensure no further migration of pollutants in the Hinkley Valley. And then that's another opportunity to gain public input and the board's input and direction. Then the prosecution team, which is Lisa Dernbach, Ann Molden, and myself, and Laura Dravant from the Office of Enforcement, we will be drafting an order. And once we have that order drafted, it will be released to the public. We anticipate that to be hopefully by end of January, early February. And then there will be a minimum 30-day public comment. We expect that we'll come back out to the community to answer questions. And during that time when it's public comment, it's an opportunity for PG&E to comment on the order. It's an opportunity for the public to comment. It's an opportunity to make changes based on comments we've seen. And then we are looking at coming back here in Barstow in April to ask the board to adopt that order. And that would be another public hearing where there is, again, another chance for changes to be made. And if the board wanted to, they could continue that hearing to a future meeting that would be likely in June. So that's our current time frame. That's the schedule we're on. And that's where you all fit in. There's several places for you to have your foot, and we encourage that. And then lastly, this is the same slide you saw earlier, just to remind everybody what to be thinking about when Kevin goes over his presentation, and he is up next.
Just give me a moment. When you speak, please speak on the outside to get you here. Lori was getting a little faint, I wonder.
Oh, I
wonder.
Okay. Let me try that. Okay. Thank you. It's nice to be here this evening. What I've got is a slide presentation that I think many of you have been able to download. I think it was on the website. And we're really talking about the groundwater model that we've been using for multiple years for multiple purposes here at the site, and what we've done to update it. So let me start kind of at the beginning. What is a model? A model, the classic definition that we talk about is a simplified representation of a system or a process. And this, picture the difference between the real plane on the left and the model on the right, I think is one that we all get. It has a lot of things that are the same. The colors are right. The shape is right. The size is different. The engines don't work. But it's enough of a representation that you can learn things about how the larger one performs by looking at the smaller one. And in a similar way, what we've done is we've built a model in a computer that tries to represent the complexity of what's happening in the groundwater at Hinkley. So in the past, we've used the model for two pretty similar but slightly different purposes. The feasibility study back in the 2010 and 2011 timeframe, for those of you who were working on the project at the time, you'll remember we did a feasibility study with a lot of addendums. We had addendum, I think we got up to 4 by the time we were done. And what we did there is we tried to compare different ways of cleaning up the plume. We came up with several of them, submitted them in response to water board review and public comments. They said, try it a little bit different, try a little more in situ here, a little more pumping here, can you make it go faster, what happens if you do A, what happens if you do B. And through a series of iterative steps, we developed a bunch of different alternatives. We started out with alternatives, I think, 1 to 4, and then we sort of liked alternative 4, and then we came up with 4A, B, C, and then we kind of liked 4C, and then we went to alternative 4C, 1, 2, and 3, and I'll apologize if my exact memory of the nomenclature is right, but we've settled largely on something around 4C2, and that's, again, just for review, how we got there. It was a step-by-step iterative process. So that's what we did with the feasibility study, with this model. We tried a bunch of different ways to clean up the plume. So now, in 2014, we did a slightly different task. We said, let's, A, look at what we've learned from building parts of 4C2, because over the last few years, we've built a lot of remedy out there. We've run a lot of remedy out there. We've been actively, in this iteration, cleaning up the plume since 2007. So we now have 7 years of information that tell us, when you do this, this is what happens to the plume. How does that square? How does that work with what the model says? But we wanted to kind of get an idea about how fast things would be working, how sensitive they were to clean up, to try to inform this discussion over how are we going to get our arms around this. I don't think it's satisfying to anyone to just say, great, it's going to take 15 years to get to X. Give us a call in 15 years and let us know how you're doing. We don't want that. The community doesn't want that. I don't think the board wants that. So we're looking at trying to come up with intelligent, science-driven ways to come up with interim guidelines. So the first thing that we did in 2014 was what we called recalibration. We said, let's get all the site data together, look at it, and make sure that we've got the model working as best as we can. So a little bit of just slight technical background here. How does the groundwater flow model work, and then what is solute transport? So the model kind of has two parts. The first part is you figure out how the water moves. You kind of don't even pay attention to whether chromium or nitrate or anything. You just figure out how the water moves. So what we do is in the computer, we'll set up a bunch of different squares, and the more squares you set up, the finer the resolution is. In the area of the plume, this is the shape of our grid. In the area of the plume, these lines are so close together, they're on top of each other. There's very, very many grid steps right here in the middle of the plume, so we can understand it very well. You go a little farther away, the grid gets a little more coarse, and a little farther away, the grid gets even more coarse. So this is kind of a standard way that models are done. You want to zoom in on the area that's in question. And then we use a series of equations the hydrogeologists have developed over the years. This model, I should add, is based on what they call model code. The underlying model is built by USGS. Okay, so we've taken a lot of the input that they've had over the years for the region-wide model. They look at everything from San Bernardino all the way up to the the Nevada border. They've developed a model for the whole area. We use some of that same as sort of a jumping off point to do that. So we set all these equations up to show how the groundwater flows. We get that calibrated. We get that works properly. And then we do another set of equations that describe the processes that affect chromium. Okay, and how chromium moves and dilutes in the subsurface, and how it attenuates. Now, I know tomorrow the board is going to be hearing about natural attenuation. For the chromium model, there's no natural attenuation in this model. We've looked at this plume enough to say that we don't think that there's a substantial natural attenuation mechanism in the main aquifer. There may be in some places around the edge, but they're not really important to cleaning up the main part of the plume. So there's none of that in here. You'll find that is what we call a model parameter. It's one of the knobs on the model that oftentimes takes a lot to kind of tune in to get it just right. We don't have it here, so that makes this a little bit simpler. So in the model, we break the model up into layers, because underneath the ground, the soil is layered in different areas. We know, for example, at the simplest, folks who have been following the project, we talk about the upper aquifer, and then we talk about the blue clay, and then we talk about the lower aquifer, right? So those are all memorialized in the model. The model that I'm going to be talking about tonight is all in the upper aquifer, because that's really the thing we're trying to clean up. We have a pocket of chrome in the lower aquifer. It's fairly well defined. It's not the main topic of our discussion. The maps that we always show, the map that's over there on the wall, that's an upper aquifer map. Now, to model the upper aquifer, we split that part of the cake into three different layers. And so that's what you're seeing here. Now, to get you oriented, this little feature here, there's three different layers. This is layer one on the top, layer two is the middle, and layer three is the deepest layer of the upper aquifer. And this is the compressor station where the plume started. And this kind of bright band here is the bed of the Mojave River. Okay, so we step out that far. And what you see here, we put in dozens of different properties into each one of those squares. We try to say, what does that square look like in the world? Let's describe it. Is it gravel, where it's very coarse, that water could flow through easily? Is it clay, that water doesn't flow through very easily? So we look at a lot of those different parameters, we put them into the model. Arguably, one of the most important, if not the most important parameter, is one I've shown here, and that's called hydraulic conductivity. And that's just a measure of how well does water go through this. Okay, and so the warmer colors here, the yellows and the orange, are higher hydraulic conductivity. The cooler colors here, the blue, are lower hydraulic conductivity. And so what you start to get a sense, if you see, you can kind of see, hey, that's the sand and the nice clean sands in the river that tend to have let water move through, you know, more quickly. Up here in the area of the plume, we see variability, and this is the reason these shapes are like this and these colors are like this are all based on wells that we've drilled, borings that we've taken, soil samples that we've taken, and pump tests that we've done that define these parameters in the different layers in the different areas. So, again, just to kind of squint and take a high-level look, you see layer three, it tends to have a lot of hydraulic conductivity. Water moves pretty well in layer three. In layer two of the model, it's a little stickier. Water doesn't move as well. And so in some ways that's good. It means the chromium doesn't move very quickly. But in some ways that's bad, because once it's in, it doesn't come out that quickly. And so we're trying to come up with these layers that reflect the complexity of what we know happens in the real world. And then lastly, layer one is sort of in between. It's a little finer than layer three, a little coarser than layer two. So we do all that, and then we put in the parameters about the chrome, and what we did then is we said, let's try to model what we know has happened out there. So since we began operations in the fourth quarter of 2007, in this area of the model, we have really good understanding about what water went where it was pumped from, what was injected where. We have flow meters on everything. So for the last 7 years, you know, one of the challenges you have when you try to model what happened 50 years ago is you're never quite sure about maybe who was pumping where, or what water was used where, or how it was used, or how big the rain was if there wasn't a weather station nearby. In this area, we have really good control. I mean, we pretty much know every gallon that went into the aquifer and our in situ was pumped out. And so we also know very well exactly how much carbon we put in. This is the area where we've done in situ. We talk about, and the board has issued us permits in the past, we talked about the central IRZ, which is sort of the barrier up here that's cutting off the plume. We've talked about the source area IRZ, which is down at the station underneath the ponds. And then this is what we call the scria, or the south central reinjection area, where we're trying to knock down some of these high concentrations. So what you see here on the left, this is what the computer said should have happened during those 6 1/4 years. Okay, so we put everything in exactly the way it happened in the real world, and the computer said, this is what the picture should look like. This is what we know happened in the real world and what we measure from the hundreds of monitoring wells that we monitor out here. So when you look at that, you have to ask yourself, how well do the pictures compare? Okay? And I'll suggest that folks who do this a lot and look at these pictures, you say, that's not too bad. And let's talk about some of the things that are good, some of the things that are less good. First of all, the distance from these wells, the computer said we should have cleaned up, about that far there. You can see, we see streaks that are about the right distance. The computer said, the carbon you put in here, it shouldn't be all the way up here yet. It should be somewhere below these four wells. Well, that's kind of what we see here. We see a lot of these shapes in broad brush look kind of similar. That when you first do a model, you put it in and you find out that, the computer says the whole thing should be white, or you should have remediated 6 inches, not hundreds of feet. This is pretty good, correlation in that. Now, you also see places where the timing works pretty well, but you'll see there's granularity. There's pieces in the real world that the model doesn't pick up. You can see here, we see a good cleanup in the actual world, but it didn't really spread out as far as the model said it would. You see those six lines there? Those are actually injection wells where we injected carbon. The computer said, hey, it should have cleaned up a little bit off to the left of that yellow dot. It didn't really. It cleaned up well down gradient. It didn't spread as far as the computer said it would. Okay, so that's the kind of subtleties that we're looking for. And again, overall does a pretty good job of predicting the areas of the treatment and the migration distance. And those are two important things. But it doesn't capture a lot of the details. Now this is in the deeper layer, and here you see probably the area that we said this is the least good alignment here. Now this is in that layer 3 in the deeper zone, and you can see the model said we've injected carbon into these wells. This area should have cleaned up. And what you see there is we still have a very recalcitrant pocket of concentrations here. And just for scale, I apologize, I wasn't clear on this. This is the scale of remaining chromium concentration in the groundwater. So the darkest is over 500. The white is under 3.1. And then these lines are 10, 50, 100, and 500. So things over 500, that's a real signal. There's times, as you've heard, we can get into discussions when we're down at levels of 5 or 10 parts per billion. At 500, we know it's the plume, we know it's there, we know what has happened. So what you see here is clearly, the model said this area should clean up. That area didn't clean up. And so that actually right now in the field is a focus of some of the work that we're doing. We've drilled additional wells. We're teasing out the story of what was different in that pocket, and we're going to go in and do focused remediation, on that area. So the takeaway from that is that the model's pretty good overall, but when you get down to any given pocket, you may have some challenges with it. And you won't really know that until you actually get out and start remediating and start doing what you said you were going to do in the model. So the other part of calibration that's really important is making sure that you understand how the model assumptions affect the results. And we went through, in the report that we submitted, we varied a lot of these parameters. And the way I think of it is, it's sort of like an old, think of the old World War II movies where you've got a guy at a radio with 10 different knobs and he's trying to dial in. We turn each of the knobs and we watch what happens. We change a hydraulic parameter is what the technical, how much water flows. We change a retardation parameter. We change an organic carbon parameter. And we see, does that make the model fit any better? And so we felt pretty good about the flow. What we didn't like, again, was sort of the spread of how that, we didn't like the way that was modeling it. So we spent a lot of time on what we call the organic carbon. And so this is the part of the model that says when you put ethanol in the ground, what happens? Does it remediate 1 inch around the well? Does it remediate 1 foot around the well? Does it remediate 100 feet around the well? And there's a lot of chemistry that goes into that. We look at how long the carbon lasts, how much carbon does it take to get the reaction that we want. Okay, and so we looked at those, and what we found, this parameter, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I want to give people a sense of what we did. We asked ourselves, how much carbon does it take to actually get the reaction that we want? And the technical term for that is the total organic carbon threshold. So this model says, in this case, once you get 1 milligram per liter of carbon in there, I'm going to assume the chrome goes away. That's what the computer's sort of saying to itself. And we said, let's try 1 milligram per liter, and let's try 0.1, a tenth of a milligram per liter. Let's try that. And so you see the difference here, okay? You see that if you assume it only takes a little tiny bit of carbon, you get bigger white areas. Let's look at, say, this one right here for comparison. You get a big white area. When you assume 1 milligram per liter, you get smaller areas. It doesn't spread out as far. And what we found is that, you know, when we changed it from that one to that one, it got better. The model seemed to be better calibrated in some places, but it seemed worse in others. Okay? So we said, you know, we don't really feel like we've got the ability to say, recommend this parameter or that. So we carried them both through. We said, both of these are kind of similar to what might happen in the world. Let's carry them both through. We spent, and again, stop me if I'm going into too much detail, but what we looked about, we talked a lot about the technical term that we called streaky. You know, we said, how streaky does this look? You know, the real world, the actual monitoring data, these points in the center here, they're kind of streaky. They're not all connected. Up here, they connected. We got a nice solid white area across there. Down here, we got streaks. Okay, how do we model that streakiness? When we put in the 0.1, we said, that doesn't look great. This looks streaky, but maybe too streaky. So it's that kind of a trade-off. So when we get to the next step, I want you to realize that we just carried through in the interest of, you know, let's let everybody take a look at it and, you know, pick one or the other. We carried through both of these assumptions in the model. So once we'd done that, we felt like we had all the dials set, and we said, all right, we feel good about how the model works. It's as good as we can make it based on all the information we have to 2014. Now, let's look forward. Okay, so we built the tool. We've calibrated it. Now we're going to start asking it questions like, what happens if I build out a remediation plan like I'm planning to? Okay, and so what we did is we started with a remedial plan that's very similar to the FS Alternative 4C2. We knew it couldn't be identical because some things have changed since 2010. The biggest thing is that in 2010, we assumed we were going to farm right in the middle of where Highway 58 is coming through. Okay, so there's things like that that are just real world. Well, now we know. The 4C2 was intended to say not that this farm has to go exactly right here, but what would happen if we have a half a dozen farms, or 10 farms, or 40 farms? Those are the kind of questions we were asking back in 2010. So we said, let's move things around. We've done a lot of work out in the field. We know where Highway 58 is going to be. We've done a lot of biological work, so we know where we can build things right now. And we had just, almost concurrent with this, we had submitted our proposal to the board under the permits that were just issued for the first layer of expansion. So we said, let's put these are the ag units that we got the permits for and we're actually building right now. So let's model what that looks like. So we have the extraction and the agricultural treatment. We have the freshwater injection going. We have the IRZ treatment, both the current system that's in there as well as the planned expansions that we can envision that will be able to be built with the biological constraints that we have. And we even did one more thing in here. We looked at our biological permitting process, and we said if everything goes as it should, in about 3 years, we should have the permits that we can extend the IRZs out. So we put that factor in. We said, okay, we're going to assume we can build here for the next 3 years, but then after that, we'll add in places once we have the final permit. So we tried to make it much more realistic based on the real world that we see right now. And then we varied that parameter. You'll see in the table I'm going to show, scenario one was the original 4C2, and that's just the numbers from there, just to give us a place to see how does it compare. Because right, one of the surprises could have been, oh, well, the model in 210 said it would take 10 years to accomplish a given goal, and now it takes 2 years, or now it takes 50 years. Right? We just wanted to kind of have that in people's mind. So scenario two and three are the ones we want to look at. It's the updated remedy design with that low TOC threshold, and scenario three is the updated remedy design also, those words are synonyms, with the high TOC thresholds. And so we then looked at, again at layer one, layer two, and layer three, and we did that to try to understand how fast different parts of the aquifer would clean up. And so these are the first kind of raw model outputs. So this is looking at the top layer, layer one, and what we did is we stacked three different model runs right next to each other so you can kind of see how they compare. And this is after 8 years. So we said, let's build this, let's run it for 8 years, you know, let's see what happens. So this was the model under 4C2, and I'll suggest that what you see is all the high concentrations are gone. There's still some pockets in the, if I've got my colors right, that's in the around the 10 part per billion range up here. There's some smaller pockets of slightly higher concentration, maybe up to 50 down in this area. So that's what the baseline, the feasibility study said. With this new update, you can see you get a pretty darn similar representation. You still have this pocket up here, might be a little bit slightly higher in concentration. Again, remember that pocket might be 9 and that color might be 11. Don't get too fixated on subtle, you know, color changes, because you have to draw a line somewhere. We draw it at 10. And then with the high TOC threshold, you can see a similar picture, but not quite as good a treatment, because in this assumption we say you got to get more carbon into the ground to actually treat it. So this, it stands to reason that this one should clean up a little better. So we run these models. We look. This is just in layer one, and that gives you a flavor of what the different runs look like. I now want to. We took an example of this is the same run. Okay, this is scenario two after 8 years. We just looked at layer one. Now let's look at the other layers. And what you see here, layer one cleans up really nicely. Okay, it cleans up very fastly. Layer two, you'll remember that's the layer that we model with the finer grain material, the stickier stuff. It cleans up much slower. But that's not where the water tends to flow as quickly. Okay, so this is sort of the parts of the plume that the model predicts, and I think stand a reason to say this is going to be the slower to clean up, but it's also not moving, you know, as quickly. So that's part of the trouble. And then layer three, the deeper zone, you can see we still have some compared to layer one, some more elevated levels. So there's a book that we submitted with all these layers, all these runs, all these different things. And so, you know, they're there to be looked at and pored over. What I'm going to show next is we tried to come up with some numbers to say, well, how do we turn these pictures into data that we can discuss? So there's a lot of different ways to measure cleanup. And for this report, we really tried to be sort of neutral on that. It's a technical report. We said, let's look at some of the different ways that one might measure cleanup. If you talk to a scientist, a lot of what they're looking at is mass, how much chromium is left in the surface. And 80% is a pretty good number to say I've treated most of the plume. You may not be done, but it's a good benchmark to say, boy, once you've got 80% of it out, you've clearly knocked down the higher strength stuff. You've done a good job at knocking down the core, as it will. So we looked at the models and said, under the first scenario that we submitted back in, or under 4C2, we got 80% reduction in about 6 years. Under scenario 2, it took about 8 years, and under scenario 3, with that kind of worst case, let's assume it doesn't work as well, TOC assumption, it took 13 years. Okay, so that's the spread that you see on that 80% number. We also said, okay, let's look at what targets might be. Okay, and the original FS looked at 50 at the time. That was the MCL for total chrome. And I'll just skip ahead. We've got 10 parts per billion now as well, which is the current. But if we look at the 50 number, we split this up by layers. And what you see here is that model layer 1, under the different scenarios, takes somewhere between 10 and 13 years to shrink the 50 part per billion line by 99%. Okay, so we sort of asked ourselves, if I'm making these numbers up, if there was 100 acres that was covered with the 50 part per billion, how long would it take to get 99% of that, get down to 1% of the initial area? Okay, so how much would it take to shrink that 50 line by 99%? And under this, it says somewhere between 10 and 13 years in layer 1, somewhere between 6 and 9 years in layer 2, or in layer 3, excuse me, and in layer 2, which is the sticky layer, somewhere between 15 and 23 years. And again, we shared this by layer because we think it's somewhat relevant to the idea of how much mass is still in areas that could be moving. Okay, layers 1 and layers 3 are where we see most of the movement. And then finally, we asked the same question for the 10 part per billion line. How long would it take to shrink that by 99%? And you can see we get not dramatically dissimilar answers in layer 1. The cleanup happens fairly quickly there. Getting all the way to 10 ppb in layer 3 seems to take a little longer. We're talking 19 to 27 years. And then in layer 2, this is the place that takes the longest. It's the stickiest. And that's 37 to 50 years. But again, I want to be careful that we're keeping this in calibration. There's a lot of progress that's been made. 80% of the plume's gone in 13 years. The places where the plume moves are gone or dramatically reduced. The last molecule of chrome, that's going to take some time, and that's what this last kind of lower right number tries to signify. So these are quotes from the report that were submitted, and again, these are for the area that we're focused on here. So time to reduce the mass by 80% ranges from 8 to 13 years. We think that might be something that the board could consider as some kind of a benchmark. We think that's an important one to look at. You want to get the chrome out of the ground, regardless of questions of concentration. Maybe it's not the only requirement, but We think it's an important thing from an engineering perspective. The time to reduce chrome concentrations to less than 50 parts per billion across 99% of the initial 50 ppb, 6 to 13 years in layers 1 and 3, 15 to 23 years in layer 2, and then the 10 ppb, 99% reduction, 11 to 27 in layers 1 and 3, and then 37 to 50. In layer 2. So again, what I've tried to show here and give you, again, I apologize if this was too much detail. What we're trying to show here is what the model should be used for and where it would be over prediction. To try to predict the concentration at a given well 5 years from now, the model is just, it's not a good tool for that. It's much better for looking at aggregate. How well are things moving over a large area? But to try to predict, MW27 is going to have this kind of occur. It's just not really designed to get that kind of granularity over it. There's a lot of uncertainties. The scale of the model, the accuracies, and all the assumptions. and the heterogeneity in the aquifer and the chromium distribution in the aquifer. And that's that first graph that I showed you, that blue blob that's left. You know, we just wouldn't have seen that in the model. We see it after we try to clean it up, and we realize the water's not going there. Why not? That gives you sort of a clue to go in and do further assessment and find these little pockets that, oh, there's a little clay pocket there that no one knew about because we hadn't drilled into it, or there's a little gravel pocket there. But over on the large scale, it's pretty good. Again, these don't provide definitive predictions. They shouldn't be used in orders with an expectation of certainty, but they are the best guideposts that we have, and I think the challenge to us is sort of how we craft them. I have two more slides with our thoughts on that, but I wanted to be very clear about where I'm trying to be a scientist and then where I'm going to try to be, you know, a suggester. So I wanted to stop here. We took this and have some ideas on how we think the board might want to consider doing that. I can go through that now, or we can talk about technical things first, whatever the board's pleasure is.
What would you like to do?
Should we see if there's technical, if there's questions? So,
is this on? Yes.
So if you, during the technical presentation, which was fairly detailed, if you have questions that you thought of, if you would raise your card and I'll come and get them. And
or they could just speak.
Or you can speak.
Would you like to ask a question? Oh, Peter?
And
can we have the people do approach here so I can at least get a recording record of it? That they have to speak into that.
Into this
that
one?
Microphone.
Okay.
Thanks. Richard Booth, Hot Water Board. Kevin, does the modeling take into account the possibility of maintenance downtime or problems with pumping? Because as you know, in the past, whenever it hasn't run optimally, sometimes the plume could get away from us, and so I'm concerned about that, if you've taken that into account.
Right. That's a good question. I think we've got, and I want to introduce somebody, Dr. Margaret Gentile here from Arcata. She's been heavily involved in the models. I don't think we tried to account for reduction in flow over time or downtime.
The model assumes fairly consistency.
Yeah.
Here,
yeah, I can answer that. Okay. No. The answer is no. We didn't try to include that level of precision in the model. You're right. If over time, for example, the pumping was down for 10% of the time, one would expect a 10% longer, you know, cleanup time. So if the remediation was down 10% of the year, a 10-year cleanup would become an 11-year cleanup.
Okay. Yeah. Other cards or questions on the technical?
Lester, if you wouldn't mind coming to the microphone, it's for the record. So I can give you this one for volume, but you need to be close to that.
Okay.
Thank you.
My question was, in the in-situ area, did PG&E install the new injection wells for the ethanol injection?
Right now, we've had in the baseline runs, we've tried to model exactly what's happened. So since 2007, there have been, I would call them, waves of different wells that were put in for ethanol injection. There was the central area, the source area, expansions of both of those, the screen, all of that timing was built into the calibration run. So if a well was drilled in 2011 and it first saw carbon in 2012, that's what we did in the model. So does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
So the ones that I'm talking about was in our technical working group meetings, the ones that were showing a very big
capture zone, cleaning area?
Yeah. Is those the ones that were going to get installed, and did they get installed, was my question.
Yeah, let me,
slide 4 or 5.
Yeah. Did I break it?
Sorry. Slide 4. Actually, a little farther.
Okay, I can. There we go. So, Lester, there have been several rounds on, so I don't want to misspeak. The recent ones that I'm thinking of were the central area infill wells. Over time, we'd watched this, and we saw some, again, that streakiness. And so we did that. We were directed to do that by the Water Board 18 months ago, something on that order. And so those have been installed. And so those are kind of infill to kind of fill in gaps in there. Right now, we're working on additional assessment and injection wells down in this source area.
Okay. And second question number two was, in the source area, what are the levels of arsenic and manganese, some of the higher levels that are being reproduced as a byproduct?
I don't have them in my memory. I apologize. I really was kind of focused on the chromium cleanup. I know they're documented in reports. I don't know them off the top of my head.
Okay. And say over the course of the next 5 years, do you have any idea how much byproduct will be reproduced as a result of cleaning the chrome 6?
Yeah. So the concept here, and again, this is one of the trade-offs and why we think an iterative approach is good. We would not put higher concentrations of carbon into a given area. Okay, we would put carbon in different areas, and so our expectation is that we shouldn't make anything that would be dramatically different or worse than what we've made already. So, for example, we're not going to go back to one of these injection wells and put more carbon in there and potentially generate higher levels of manganese or higher levels of arsenic. What we do is we'd say, oh, let's go step up here and put carbon in there, or let's step over here and put carbon in there. And so we wouldn't expect to see dramatically different levels than what we've seen to date. And I would even go one step farther, and that I think as we've learned about how the manganese and arsenic are formed, I think we can do a little better job of control. Now, again, a lot of variability. I wouldn't want to promise that we'd never make another bit of arsenic or manganese. That's why the EIR built all the mitigations around the potential for byproducts, and we'll be obviously following the monitoring programs that are spelled out in the EIR, and if necessary, the mitigations, if there is a lot made.
The reason I come up with these questions is because a couple of years ago, when I was talking to Bob Doss about the arsenic and the manganese, he told me that as arsenic would flow across the desert, it would eventually disappear, but if you're hydraulically controlling the plume, there's no place for that arsenic to dissolve to. So my concept of this is you're going to keep remediating it and pulling it back and putting it back in the injection wells. You're going to keep increasing the concentrations of arsenic and manganese.
Right.
And eventually they will continue to skyrocket if nothing's ever remediated in that area. And that's my final question.
Yeah. And that's a valid observation if we just recirculate that water. What the tool that we have here is that some of that water we'll be able to take out and apply to the ag units down here, and so that will give one buffer out. And frankly, understanding that dynamic is one of the reasons that what we want to see in this is an adaptive remedy, that we can look at those things, watch them over time, see the trends that are going in. If we start to see a trend that either wasn't anticipated or that it looks markedly, very different than what we were expecting, that we can, come together and say, okay, we're seeing this trend, we don't like it, what do we do about it?
So, thank you. So, I do notice a few new faces in the crowd, folks from the community that I don't recognize from previous meetings. And I'm just wondering, there may be some acronyms or terms that we might be using that may not be as familiar to you. So on one of your slides, you had TOC.
Yeah.
Wanted to say that's total organic carbon, IRZ, in situ remediation zone. So there are technical terms that and acronyms that are commonly used, but you may not be as familiar. So please don't be afraid to ask questions to make sure that you understand what this very technical presentation is saying.
If you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
Thank you.
Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Been a while.
My first question is, this model does not address the Chrome 3 to Chrome 6 regeneration, the possibility of that. So I would think that it would be something that would at least addressed in this presentation of the model.
Right, right. So the question that that Darren's asking is about what we show here. These numbers are all about Chrome 6, which is the hexavalent chromium, which is, you know, what we've been focused on. And this model assumes that when we get carbon into contact with it, that Chrome 6 changes to Chrome 3 and then absorbs to the aquifer. Okay. Darren's question is, what about the reverse? Can the reverse happen? And this is a, you know, subject that we've looked at a lot. We documented in the feasibility study in the EIR. We don't think it's a significant mechanism. I don't want to say it's zero, because zero is a really big number, but we don't think that it's a significant mechanism that would cause dramatic, what we call rebound, for this work to basically be undone. Now, to be fair, it's an open question, and it was enough of an open question that as part of the USGS study, Task 8, Dr. Izbicki is going to look at that exact question. I mean, I'll say from my perspective, my read on the technical data, I could not recommend to my company that we go out and go through all this effort and spend all the money to build these in situ zones and take the time to do it if I thought it was all going to come undone. But I'll accept that there are folks who may, you know, have that question. This model does not take into account the idea of back conversion.
Is it possible that water flow is a guideline for the use of the model, and under the ground, the actual ground flow is much more complex, meaning that the water flow isn't an exact science. We don't exactly know what's going on there. I mean, the possibility of the water flow going directly north, that's just a possibility in theory. We don't know whether or not it could be going other directions.
Right. So, to speak to that, that is what we try to get into in this calibration, you know, effort. And what I feel pretty good to say is that the general groundwater flows, we know which way groundwater flows because we know water flows downhill. And this is a place where the extensive monitoring network that we've had for 10 years or more, we've got water level data every quarter from hundreds of wells. So we have a good idea of the shape of the water table, and the shape of the water table dictates basically where the water flows. What I do want to be clear about, though, is that on this scale, there can be pockets that we just don't have that level of understanding at. So there is uncertainty in the model. I don't want to misrepresent that. You know, the model did not show this pocket here, right? No question about that. That's probably a pocket of clay or something that's a little lower permeability that the model didn't show. But in terms of, you know, we know the general direction that the water flows. We know it flows, generally south to north. You know,
so there is a possibility that it could flow other directions other than just directly north.
Within very small areas, but on the regional scale, I don't think there's any possibility. There's just too much data that says it's flowing north.
My last is kind of a question comment. I'm no modeler, of course, and I'm not an expert, but referencing to slide 6, the comparison between your actual measurements and your model predictions are difficult to see and understand in slide 6.
Do you want me to take a shot? I mean, are there?
Yeah,
no. Let me.
Yes.
So what? This is what the computer said would happen. We told the computer, let's put in every single thing that we've done from the time 2007 to 2014. We know in the real world this is what happened. This is the map that we made of the plume in January of 2014. We went out, we sampled the wells, We put them on a map, and this is the shape we got. The white areas were cleaned up. The dark blue areas basically weren't cleaned up at all. Okay. So then we look at, here's what the real world says, here's what the model says. There's places where it looks pretty good, Darren. Like the general, like where this green arrow is pointing. This is what happened in the real world. This used to be all dark blue in here. Now it's white. That looks pretty similar, you know, to that. What it didn't do a good job of, in the real world, we have this streakiness. We have this finger here, right? It didn't predict that. It didn't predict that finger. The model said, boy, that should have been all gone, right? So it tells us that we know roughly how far it'll go pretty well. We can count on the model for distance. We can't really count on the model to predict all these little pockets, you know, that there are going to be pockets that are going to pop up as we do this, that are just, they're going to take longer to clean up. The carbon's not going to go into them. They're going to go slower. And that segues to, you know, where I think we ought to go, which is I'm jumping to my conclusions. That's why every 4 years we ought to look at this again and say what's working, what's not, and there's technical reasons that we think 4 years is the right number that I'd be happy to go into. But that's why you can't just believe a computer, set it up to run, and come back in 20 years. It doesn't work like that. You have to kind of adjust and see where the computer was right and where it wasn't.
Are there any more questions from members of the public?
Sure. Come on up.
And then after that, after the public questions, I'll go to board members.
Hi, Kevin. How you doing? Some of these questions I'm going to ask are probably impossible to answer, so I ask them in the spirit of just kind of facilitating conversation, dialogue, etc. So I mean, hopefully understand the spirit in which I'm asking them. I think obviously there's a lot of conversation about this model as we move ahead, so maybe these can be said right now, you can acknowledge them possibly, and we'll punt them to that discussion later. And some of these are said obviously for the benefit of the community members sitting here to promote the dialogue that I think the IRP manager is supposed to promote with PG&E and the Water Board. I guess question number one really is on your slide number 4, which is the classic little box at the bottom where you've got mass flow in, mass flow out, and you set up your differential equations around that. So to be clear, there is a chrome 6 to chrome 3 reaction kinetics associated with that box, correct?
Not kinetics. Margie, do you want to... We'll have PhD to PhD here.
So we have it on the record. Okay. Yeah, so what we find when we look at the chemistry of chromium reduction is that once you have the thing that reduces the chromium present, it goes really quickly, right? We're talking minutes.
So your rate constant is infinite.
Right. So we didn't even put it into the model. We didn't put how quickly the chromium gets reduced in the model. What we put in was the kinetics, how fast the carbon is consumed. So when we put in the ethanol, how quickly is it consumed? And that tells us how far it moves. And then that other parameter that Kevin was talking about, which is how much do you need to get that chromium reaction to happen. So the model looks at how, you know, it has lots of math around how the ethanol is degraded and how it moves around and how much triggers chromium reduction. But once that amount is in a certain location, then the model just says, okay, now the chromium is consumed. And that's pretty consistent with what we see in the monitoring data. So when we look at a given monitoring well, you know, you don't see a really slow decrease in chromium concentration. You kind of see it at a given level. And then once you see the ethanol arrive in the form of TOC, or you see iron arrive, the chromium, boom, goes down.
Okay. All right. We probably should continue that response discussion later on. But I appreciate the mark. I guess point number 2, and I guess this maybe picks up on Darren's remark on slide number 6, and again, this is probably impossible to answer, but you know, if I was looking at that, what I would do is you got model prediction on the left, you got actual on the right, Correct. And so I think there's some information to be in mind that if you overlay one over the other and subtract one from the other, you're going to end up with some chrome zones remaining. And I'd be curious to think, you know, what that actually means with respect to model versus reality. And so it's really a different way of looking at performance versus prediction. But I am, I'm a big believer in experimental data, and you try and model it and use the model as a tool for future work. I think this is the right way to tackle the future performance monitoring of this project. I'm all for the modeling effort. But that's a remark I'd like to see, that, you know, track these two, and I think there's some meat to be mined from that. I got a couple more quick ones. And they are kind of impossible to. So at the end of your presentation, you talked about recommended metrics that could be used to go into the CEO eventually, etc. Maybe the Water Board and yourself can discuss, is PG&E going to recommend your best shot at these KPIs or metrics, and then the Water Board will accept them and you go back and forth?
Yeah, we tried to reproduce some of the things. There was a lot of discussion around this at the feasibility study stage, right? Back when we were talking about the feasibility study, we had to ask the question, what does good look like, right? Because I remember coming to the board saying, okay, the simple question that everyone says, when is the last molecule of chrome gone? And the model says 100 years. Right? And we said, but wait, most of the chrome, the meaningful part of the chrome, how do we define that? And so we really just tried to do this, you know, frankly, to be kind of agnostic on it. I mean, I think that's a discussion that, we'd like to have some input. I know as an engineer, I'd like to have input from, you know, the board and others, but as an engineer, 80%, I think about mass. I really do. I think that once you get the kilograms, the pounds of chrome out of the system, then good things will happen. But I very much understand that the public tends to think about concentration. You know, is the level above or below background, above or below the MCL? I mean,
I think there's a project space where PG&E, the Water Board, and the CAC, there's an overlap between all these points where these IRTs, these intermediate targets, are generated. And I think, I mean, obviously, your work is the fulcrum of generating that knowledge. So naturally, I think it would come out of PG&E, but we hope there's a process where the other stakeholders can obviously view and vet these kind of metrics, performance metrics. And then to not hog the is your modeling work completed?
For right now, I think we feel that we've answered the mail and. Answer the specific request of the Water Board. We think we've got tools here to frame the discussion, but if there's again, I caution folks against building another 100 dimension, you know, what about this choice, what about that choice, but you know, we're available to do it if needed.
Roughly, this is a number that you might not be able to bring. In what 8% mass removal, how many pounds of chrome 6 is that?
I don't have that in my head. I'm sorry.
Roughly. Yeah. It'd be interesting to know that number. That completes the remarks.
Thank you. Are there any more comments from members of the public? Okay. So questions from board members on the technical presentation.
If you wouldn't mind.
Thank you. Just a quick comment. I think it's an important first step in a long path, and I think it needs to be reevaluated every 4 years, as you suggest. But because the whole situation is changing. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions from board members?
Thank you. Thank you, Gita. Let me find my notes here. Maybe there's an intuitive point that I'm missing, but why is less more? We need you get to the injection on the point one. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe you can remediate a little bit
here. Okay. What we're showing here is this says, let me back up. The way we model is we put a concentration of ethanol, TOC, into a well. And then, as Margie said, there's a lot of math around how far that spreads. On this one, we say, if you only get a little tiny bit of ethanol there, that's going to be enough to make the chrome go away. So that treatment area looks bigger because a little tiny bit goes farther than this case where you need a lot of it to get the ethanol. So we sort of ask ourselves, we sort of say, okay, this is a measurement of where we were able to successfully get one part per million. That's kind of a lot. That's kind of a lot of ethanol. And wherever we get one part per million, we'll make the chrome disappear. So we get that. Let's just talk about the white blood. We get that white blood. So that's where we got one. Just beyond that, we got 0.9, and then 0.8, 0.7. Then we get way out here, we still have 0.1. In this model, it says, oh, 0.1's enough. So that's where less carbon spreads farther, and in this assumption, we say that's enough to get the chrome to reduce.
Okay, so these are the bookends of your of your model,
right.
Essentially.
Right.
Okay. On the, I think it's the chart before that, it's this chart with the green.
Yeah.
The green lines.
Yeah.
You mentioned the modeling every 4 years. How often is the water quality data analyzed for these areas, or is it a whole network of monitoring wells?
Well, that's to be, I think, worked out as part of this. Right now, we do quarterly monitoring, and when I get to my recommendation, the 4 years really doesn't have to do with the monitoring. What we felt the 4 years has to do with is the cycle time to design an IRZ expansion, build it. That's about a year to a year and a half to go to check all the permit biobox. You know, if we said today, Kevin, go build a IRZ up here, about 18 months from now, we'd be ready to flip the switch. And then what we've seen from this, and this is a soft number, we get most of the benefit out of a new IRZ well in about 18 months or so. We get the biggest benefit in the first few months, but we still get a little more. After about 2 years, we've gotten as much as we're going to get. And so that build time coupled with a decent operating time, that sort of says that's about how much you're going to get out of that cycle. Let's take a snapshot, let's look at the data that we gathered during that time, and let's do it again. You know, it's a little bit like whack-a-mole. You know, we'll do it, we'll find a pocket that we missed, the data will show that, we'll design the next iteration, and each time those will get smaller and smaller and smaller. And so that's really what drove our suggestion for 4 years. EPA guidance says 5 years. We think we can do better than that. You know, we think we can do it quicker here because of, to Ian's question, because of the actual reaction is instantaneous. Yeah.
Okay, on this chart that you have up, it shows shallow. The next chart shows deep.
Deep, yep.
At what point is the injection? Is it a multi-port injection system?
Or? Yes.
Okay, so you're basically dosing all of the zones.
Yes.
In your modeling.
Yeah. So this is sort of, you can think of this at roughly as layer three, and this one is layer one. And again, it's important, you know, we looked at each layer to see how it was, you know, corroborating there.
And with the three layers that you're showing, and I'm looking at Bates Camp 2-27, I'm not sure which chart it is for you. Yeah, no,
that one. Yeah.
What is the depth of each of those layers? Is this just hypothetical at this point, or do you have actual
data? Oh, no, we have actual data. And
I mean, is it the top of layer one starts at roughly about 80 feet, the bottom of layer 3 is about 140, and then, you know, it's cut up in between those depths.
Okay, so, okay, good. Well, that tells me that.
In general, you shouldn't answer from your seat.
The top of layer one is about 80 feet, and the bottom of layer three is about 140 feet. So it's on the order of 60 feet in the area.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's helpful. That gives me at least the bottom and then where we are in between. I think the modeling is an excellent tool. I'm probably a little less enthusiastic than what you are. I will definitely, you know, be looking for more data, because I don't think you can draw a picture from, you know, just one data point or one set of modeling, especially a problem as complex as this. But I do think it gives us a starting point, at least in this one segment. Thank you, Gina.
Thank you. Other board member comments?
No. So I do if nobody else does.
Okay.
I want the slide up that has layers 1, 2, and 3 on the 8-year run. Keep going. Oh, yeah, no, that's it.
Okay.
I'll stand over here.
But thank you.
So these are pretty simple questions. The first question is, so if the 100% of the mass so is distributed throughout the three layers, would you say the distribution is 33%, 33%, 33% in layers 1, 2, and 3, or is the distribution of the mass of chromium different between the different layers?
It's different. I'm not sure I know the percentages. I think based on this kind of data that we have more of the mass in the shallow. I don't think we've asked the question like that before.
We've run the calculation to look at what the model would calculate as the mass in the various layers. But
we could do that, though.
We can do that.
We will do that.
Yeah, and just to calibrate a little bit, that as Kevin was kind of saying, layer one really represents what we typically see in the shallow unit of the upper aquifer, and layer three, the deep unit of the upper aquifer. And layer two is sort of less the basic case. So in certain parts of the site, that represents a clay unit. In other parts of the site, it represents some of the tighter layers. But it's not something that is as certain. That's been mapped, and that we have it well mapped, and we have the chromium distribution well described. So that's another just element of uncertainty. So when we're talking about what's coming out of layer two, it is much more difficult, and we do expect that there are spots and areas that are like layer two, and that's why we think it's important to this discussion. But it's more of like an upper bound on time frame and treatment. It's not necessarily like a discrete layer across the site that is just going to be sitting there. It's more representative of pockets and more like thinner types of things.
And maybe just to understand how layer two was added to the model. Back in 2010, when we just had layer one and layer three, and we were already pumping at the Desert View Dairy, right? And we looked at that and we said, my gosh, it looks like it should all be clean. We know it's not clean. We know it's stickier. The chrome is hanging around longer. And so we looked at that, and we looked at the geology. And, you know, as Marty said, layer two is not, you know, you can't go out and grab a handful of layer two. But we said we need to make something in there.
The stickier area.
It models a stickier area.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, it would be useful to know, I guess, at least for layers one and three. So it seems to me that there might be different cleanup strategies if it's distributed, just if we're using those two layers, 50-50 versus 90-10.
Yeah.
Because of seeing the response here in the model, how much more recalcitrant, if it's more recalcitrant is in that layer 3, you know, if that's 10% of the mass, or if that's 90% of the mass, it suggests different, you know, cleanup right. scenarios. So it'd be
we can look at that. That's okay.
But for reference, there are elevated concentrations, like above 1,000 milligrams per liter in both.
I understand that.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. How would, if we added agricultural treatment units on top of these areas and or the bioreactor, how might that change the estimates that you're getting from this model?
So the that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it because that means I didn't explain what we did here. Is that we have ag units on top of these right now.
Okay.
So the way the cleanup works is pump and treat the ag units. I think of this as, you know, the slow extraction, waiting for the chromium to diffuse out. So the ag units help, and they help keep things from spreading farther. But what really makes something change from blue to white is the in situ. And that's been the tension in this remedy. You know, that's why we modeled all in situ and all pumping back in 2010. So your eye sees in these models the impact of the IRZs. But we assume that there's two ag units operating on top of there. Just as we showed, let me go back. So we're assuming that all of the existing light tan ones are running, and that the Desert View Dairy is running, and these two new green ag units that we're building right now, they're all running through this whole simulation.
Okay. And the bioreactor, that gets added, how that?
Bioreactor is not in there. We would model the bioreactor from what the ground sees is dirty water coming out and clean water going in. So one could start to do different simulations of where a bioreactor might go. The bioreactor was not included in this set of simulations yet.
So depending on where it goes, I mean, you don't really know how it might affect.
Right. So for example, I mean, the iterations that we go through, let's say we were trying to improve this performance, right? We would look at this and say, okay, depending on whether you said try to get more mass out or try to get more concentration down, let's say your directive was, look, we want to get everything less than 10 here. So we would look at these areas and say, how would we do that? We'd probably try doing in situ up there, knowing that that's a new area of a byproduct creation. We would try pumping, and I'll tell you, we have tried pumping, and that's the stickiness that, you know, kind of lets go. So we could, you know, we could show some compare and contrast things. Like, you know, if, I mean, if it was helpful to folks, you know, we could say, let's assume 100 gallon a minute bioreactor and pump more water out of here and pump it into there and see what happens. I think I know that you'll see some small incremental improvements by pumping and treating, but you won't change that 8 years into 4 years. If we go back to the FS, you know, we tried that. We tried moving much, much, much more water, and you kind of hit a point of diminishing returns. That you pump a lot more water, it just doesn't come out of the sponge that right. much faster.
And one last simple question is, so what's the lead time for designing and installing new IRZs?
Yeah, so if I may, I think I've got this is.
Do you want to just, I mean, guys, launch into your recommended?
Yeah, maybe how that.
Okay.
How that, because it say the lead time's on the order of 18 months.
Okay.
I did have one more question.
Sure.
Sorry to steal your ending there, but Mike Plasiak with the Water Board. Question I have is, you know, your output are going to be as accurate as your input data. So the question I have is, did you do a sensitivity analysis on the model to know or get a sense of which of your parameters are really the most sensitive so that you know, a small tweak or just a you know, small inaccuracy in that input parameter might result in a huge difference in your output. In other words, in the non-technical terms, the radio analogy, which knob on this radio that if you turn a little bit, you're going to blow the speakers.
Right. yes, and that was a lot of what, you know, was documented in the earlier, you know, reports on this. And we got to the point that we said this knob is sensitive enough that we don't want to pass judgment on where to set that knob. That's why you see the two scenarios. You know, and basically we said we want to be open book technically. And again, if you know, I think if someone were to review it and say, you know, I'm wondering about that knob, we can drill back in and do a sensitivity analysis on any one of them. They're in the reports. We feel pretty good based on the close calibration to start with. Like I said, we feel we understand water flow here pretty well. It was really more about the carbon, and that rapidly distilled down to that TOC threshold question.
And I'm Lori Kemper, Assistant Executive Officer. A question related to some of these options, I guess, that some folks have asked. Something like the bioreactor, you could model that, as you mentioned, and it might be that it's employed to deal with some sort of hotspot like you showed, those sticky areas, or and this is something I just want to encourage the public to think about in terms of Ian's question about how do we get at, you know, is the board, water board, just going to take Kevin's recommendations and put those in an order related to how we measure progress or where we measure progress? And I think that that's not how we're doing it. I mean, we're taking input tonight, so we're hearing next Kevin's going to discuss his recommendations. But I'm interested in hearing from folks if there's areas they see on that map that they're concerned about because maybe what's happening on the ground is not replicating what was being modeled, and it happens to be located near your house or near some other receptor. Those are some areas where it would seem like we might want to look at a little closer or look at turning the knobs. I mean, look at, can we employ bioreactor? Can we increase the carbon there, the injection rates, or things like that? So, because obviously they're capable of testing a number of questions, but that will take a long time if they try to answer, like, what if we put the bioreactor in 17 different locations? But if there are specific spots where we're seeing things based on, you know, what the actual data is showing us, those are things that we might want to ask PG&E to go back and do some more evaluation on. And then with the purpose in mind of potentially having some sort of measurable goal that might just be focused on a particular geographic area. So, you know, we've been talking about 80% mass across the whole area. We've been talking about concentrations, but we might also be talking about specific goals over time in different locations. And I want to just remind everybody, too, that the modeling was only done for this area that's depicted on that page, which is what we call the core area of contamination up to about Thompson Road. But there has been no modeling of any kind of cleanup happening north of there. And as you've seen when we discussed the plume map, there are some pockets up north where the concentrations are maybe a little higher. You know, some areas maybe are close to 3.1 or 5, some are 10 or 30 or something like that. So I think the bioreactor or other techniques are available to address these kind of anomalous things that are maybe are outside of even the areas that Kevin has modeled. So I don't know if that's a question or obviously a comment, but
and maybe just to again calibrate the scale. You know, these areas. This is the Desert View Dairy, right? This is the ranch AU. These are largely PG&E owned parcel. There's no homes in there, right? So this is areas that's essentially on PG&E land at this point. These pockets remaining in the core plume. So to the extent that, you know, that's a
one area might be more important than others.
Right. And you know, again, I mean, I want to be real clear. We're happy to do whatever modeling, you know, the board is interested. I would caution against overinterpreting this pocket versus that pocket, because, you know, as we saw from the, you know, what worked and what didn't, right, you know, you're going to get variability, and you won't know that till you're really out there. And that's where we think the better use of time and resources is. And let me just kind of segue to this: is to kind of get out there. Let's set a forecast, and then let's measure, and then let's adapt. So the concept that we were talking about is, you know, we can run this model out on any increment that we decide. So we can say, and we just picked 4 years, largely based on construction and operation times. When we look at how long you want to do this, you know, it takes about a year to 18 months to kind of design, permit, build, and be ready to really turn on, you know, a large-scale expansion. And then if we run it for around 18 months to 2 years, that gives, you know, you'll still get a little bit of improvement after that, but you've got most of what you're going to get. That gives us a roughly a four-year cycle to say, let's see how we did, you know. And so we could write goals along the lines, you know, of these. It's a forecast. Anticipate average concentrations, you know, less than 10 ppb across 75% of the shallow zone and 20% of the deep zone. We know that there may be areas above where we couldn't get in because of bioclearance for this first one, because we know we won't have perfect biological clearance. And then we also know we're going to find aquifer heterogeneity. But then it's really about adaptive management, that we take those snapshots, we watch those things, and as we see places coming up that aren't getting treated, we know, okay, that's our target, you know, for the next build-out cycle. You know, frankly, one of the things that we want to avoid is sort of, I'll call them knee-jerk or kind of rash decisions. Like, we can look back on the old data sets to see kind of how these things have evolved, you know. You know, I think we can come up with a review process that says, okay, this is where a pocket's left. We know we want to get that. Let's hit that in the next cycle, you know. And just keep repeating that process, because that will also inform us better to some of the questions that Lester was raising. You know, where are we on byproducts? Where are we in terms of drought? You know, where are we in terms of drawdown? Do we have the right mix of tools? EPA, Superfund, they typically recommend 5-year review cycles. We think, again, just given the reality, we think we'll know before 5 years. So rather than say in a 5-year cycle, we think we could do it in a 4-year cycle and just have the paces go that much quicker, you know, for that. So, you know, we propose to prepare a good report, compare the treated to model predictions, look at what's the chromium doing. We can look at other redox indicators. If we think that, oh, it's almost there, it's going to come next quarter, you know, we can have those discussions. And then if it's not meeting those expectations, if there's more pockets than we thought, or we're just not hitting those goals, then we say, look, here's we're going to have to try harder on the next 4-year cycle. Here's a plan for twice as many IRZs. Does that look good to the water board? You know, and that kind of question.
Thank you. I think you're done. Yeah.
So put our slide back up.
The question? Yeah. So I want to bring people back to the question at hand. How should the new cleanup order be structured to hold PG&E accountable? Given the technical presentation you've heard, questions that may have come up in your mind, how would this be structured as we move forward? Yep.
So Peter,
yes.
Sure.
I didn't know if it was clear in terms of the process. I think Lori had it. I'm Kim Niemeyer. I'm counsel for Lahontan Board, and the question that Ian brought up on how this information is going to be used and kind of what the steps are. So Lori sort of described it. I just want to make sure everyone understood how this works. So PG&E has provided this model. There may be more information that Lori and Lisa and Ann and Laura Drabant need to prepare a cleanup and abatement order. they'll take that information and they'll put out a draft order, and then you all will get the opportunity to comment on it. PG&E will have the opportunity to comment on it, and all those comments will come in. There'll be a response to those comments provided by Lori's team, and then Patty, myself, Richard Booth, and Doug Smith, we advise the board members, and we'll look at those comments, we'll look at those responses to comments, we'll perhaps make other recommendations to the board also. There'll be a hearing, and at that hearing there'll be another opportunity for the public and others to, and PG&E to provide input to the board. And at that point then the board would make a decision. So there's going to be lots of information coming in, there's going to be drafts and comments and responses, and so it really is a participatory process.
Yeah. And I guess just to add to that, because I do think our kind of formal process is, Kim just laid it out, but obviously tonight's discussion, you might leave tonight thinking about other ideas of other ways to measure things, or things you heard today you liked, or something pops into your head related to this discussion, or maybe in conversations with Ian and the Community Advisory Committee, you have some other suggestions, you know, specific suggestions on ways to measure progress or time frames, whether you like 4 years or 2.5 years or five, or for these check-ins. Any ideas you have, you can send those to the Water Board before we have a formal comment period. I mean, that can be, you know, notes can be taken like at tonight's meeting or at future Community Advisory Committee meetings. Comments can be written to the board, and that can be something that the prosecution team does look at. I mean, that's why we're here tonight, is really to get input. But I realize this is a really complicated matter. You may go back home, do some more of your own thinking or research or reading, have some other questions. And at this stage of the game, the Water Board staff does not have a specific path we're headed down. We're not taking Kevin's recommendation and saying, oh, yeah, that's what we plan to put in the order. We're here tonight to really hear people's questions and concerns and to try to think creatively about these, the ways to do this. So we aren't, like I said, we're not really going to start writing anything down until December. So over the next few months, while any of us are in and around Hinckley at public meetings, we can take your ideas and try to figure out, you know, the best ways to move forward. So I want to make that clear as the early process, and then we have the very formal process of we'll try to write something that we think is clear and people can understand and we can live with, you know, for whatever time frame this new order is in effect, and then it'll go out for this formal public process. So those can come, and those will be part of the public record, so they'll be able to be viewed by PG&E or the board members themselves, or anyone will be part of the public record at that point.
Okay. So, discussion?
Yeah.
Any more discussion on this item? Right. So Kevin has suggested a 4-year review cycle. Any thoughts from those of you in the public?
I think the 4-year cycle is appropriate and fine, just to keep up on it. I guess after I talked the last time, Kevin had made I just want us to be concerned about the fact of the regeneration. I know that you had said you guys had looked into it a lot. That's a new science comparatively when we talk about science. So the people at the ground floor and that basically develop this science obviously feel that it's a concern. And so whether the work we're looking at 10, 20, 30 years, we don't want to chase a tail. So, I mean, you're not always right. So that's a concern. We don't want it to have to come back. I know that Kevin, you and PG&E are suggesting cutting back on the on the quarterly testing or the at least the amount of wells. The plume changes almost quarterly, and so we know that it moves around depending on where it's pushed or what's cleaned up or whatever. And I also, I mean, I spoke to Dr. Izbicki this afternoon, so I know he feels the same way. That, and I believe he spoke to you about it. You know, I, the community or the CAC, and please, or talk to Dr. Izbicki about it also. I mean, we feel that we need to continue to collect that data. It needs to be there for the background study so that we get this done properly the first time. And also to the fact that the plume changes almost every time we do it. So if there's change in it, it seems reasonable that we continue to test it. So thanks.
Thank you. Other comments on time frame, on process?
I'll make one last remark. As the IRP manager overseeing, you know, the community's participation as a stakeholder in this, I think the process that, you know, I want everyone to know, in my personal opinion, that the process that PG&E's followed here, which basically is design part of a remedy, implement it, then attempt to model it based upon a tremendous amount of data. And modeling is a complex science, it's inaccurate, but it's a guide mechanism into the future. I think it's the high scientific, highly appropriate way to proceed. The other thing that Kevin added on the end, which I think is music to my ears, is the adaptive management process, which is, given the inaccuracies of the model, there will be milestones that are not met, but then through an adaptive management process in place between the Water Board and PG&E, changes can be made on the fly, to use these words, on the fly, in the middle of the work, basically to correct these kind of modeling inaccuracies or modeling unpredictable events. So overall, you know, from my perspective, while there's some little rough edges around this, I do applaud PG&E for the tremendous amount of work obviously went into this, and Margie too. I mean, your team must have been a tremendous amount of work. There's like five PhD theses in this work, and you know, I take my hat off to the work here, and as someone who's done some modeling work in the past, it's a great piece of work. Thanks.
Thank you. Other general comments? Time frame, frequency of check-ins, process, opportunities for input. Okay, seeing none.
So I have one comment. Should I make it now or?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Well, I concur with everyone else who has spoken on this issue so far, that the four-year cycle, review cycle, seems like a very reasonable cycle to go on. So I agree with that idea. On your first slide of the recommended remediation goals, which isn't up there anywhere, but you talked about, you know, having 75% to 80% of the shallow zone at 10 parts per billion and 20 to 40% of the deep zone. I'm just stuck on the chart, the modeling results that shows that the deeper zone is more recalcitrant to the DOC treatment. And so it gets back to my question of where's the distribution of the chromium vertically, and then is there a way to modify the IRZ technology such that if more of it is in the lower zone, that you can treat that more quickly than the upper zone. So I would like that kind of information, and that would help, I think, craft a better order.
Thank you. Okay. Next item.
So we would just take a
few minute break.
Yeah. So what we'll do now is we'll just take a break for 10 minutes, give the board staff a chance to kind of summarize comments. The board will come back up to the front. The staff will report the summary. Board will discuss and provide feedback. And then we'll move on to item 3.
Great. Thank you. So we'll resume in 10 minutes.
Which is
5 after 9.
Not very fun stuff.
Sorry.
Everybody gets up.
Lori, are you ready? Are you guys ready? So we will reconvene and finish up on item 2.
All right, I'm going to try to summarize and ask you a couple of questions. So first off, I'm going to start with some of the questions that I heard tonight that we want to ask PG&E to investigate. So I heard that it would be very helpful to know where the mass is located within the three layers to understand the percentage of the total chromium and how much is in layer 1, 2, and 3. So we want, like PG&E, to evaluate that, try to get that information to us. And the purpose of that is to really understand whether we should be focusing our treatment efforts in the areas with the greatest mass. So this next question is, can the IRZ be adjusted to address those areas where the greatest mass of chromium occurs with those layers? And I guess not just can, but like when or how quickly, because it may be that the current IRZ systems already exist and they can just apply more carbon to the deeper layer. They may need to install additional wells in different locations, and so just understanding what the reality of that is and the timing of that. So those are some things that would be helpful to get from PG&E, say, before the 1st of December, so that the Water Board could use that in drafting the cleanup order. We heard general support for ongoing data collection, that the modeling is a great predictive tool, but that we want to continue to verify the models as we move forward and to continue to have a robust monitoring program. And I do want to just remind the board that we're going to talk more about that in November, and you'll probably hear at that meeting the recommendation from PG&E and also just some of the criteria they're looking at in terms of evaluating monitoring, but that'll be a topic of November. I also heard general support for the concept that a report be done by PG&E every 4 years where they evaluate the effectiveness of the treatment and they provide recommendations for adjustments. And that's primarily due to the fact that it takes about 18 months to design and build a new IRZ area. And then to operate it for a couple of years and then to be able to have data to actually see what's going on and be able to make recommendations based on that. One of the questions the prosecution team has for the Water Board is that something that that four-year time frame, how do we account for other adjustments along the way? I think right now we're used to dealing with quarterly reports and we've seen PG&E be quite responsive to especially minor adjustments, how you define minor, but just the notion of is there still the ability for the Water Board to require adjustments, maybe small adjustments along the way, knowing that maybe the larger ones get done every 4 years. So that's something we'd like to hear a little more input on, as well as the need to, in conjunction with that requirement to provide a four-year report, are there some other thresholds or triggers that we want to put in the order that if those are not met, that something happens either before or in connection with that four-year report. So that's an area we'd like to get a little more clarity from you if you have ideas. And then lastly, I just want to suggest from the prosecution team that based on some of the other questions we heard tonight, specifically the question about reconversion of chrome-3 back to chrome-6, the USGS background study, the larger contract, includes a task for the USGS to evaluate the potential for reconversion, and it also includes a task for the USGS to review the validity of PG&E's model. And I don't know what the dates of those task reports may come to us separately, but I would suggest that the cleanup order include a specific trigger that would say once we get the final reports from the USGS on any of these questions, whether it's a new background number or reconversion or the modeling itself and the estimating, ways to improve treatment, that the board reevaluate the cleanup order based on the results from the USGS study. So that's what I have.
Okay. Okay, board members, do you have any feedback on those, on what we've heard from the staff, the summary of what we heard this evening?
Just quickly, I'd like to continue the quarterly adjustments, minor adjustments, along with the four-year potential major adjustments. I like the notion of adaptive management periods, you know, make sure that we're going down the right path on the long term to address the issue.
Okay.
I support everything that you just talked about.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Dias?
I agree with Lori's summary.
To the point. Mr. Pumphrey?
I think the majority of my concerns probably relate to our discussion in November. Mm-hmm. I think that what PG&E has done in terms of developing the model and then running it out and giving us a sense of what predictably could be accomplished is a fine piece of work. It's a big piece of work. But we also, as we sit here and talk about this, we all understand that it's probably not going to be completely accurate. So the real question isn't, is this model useful? The real question in my mind is, what do we do with the inaccuracies? What do you do as you discover that what happens in reality doesn't match what was predicted? So I think one of the things that I would wonder if you can do is, can you find places where some inaccuracies are more foreseeable than others, mm-hmm. So that you would know that you need to monitor around, mm-hmm. or look at the parameters that go with those more places where you just know that the model is probably not as accurate as you would want it to be. Mm-hmm. And can you monitor inside those things in a time frame that's less than 4 years, if that would be helpful to tightening down some of those areas of predictable unpredictability. Mm-hmm. I also think that in addition to monitoring to determine whether or not the progress predicted by the model is coming true, because we want to be modeling for other consequences that we might not have foreseen, and certainly consequences that are foreseeable in terms of byproducts and other things like that. So it's not just a question of what is the operation doing with respect to the chrome, it's also what is the operation doing with respect to the aquifer and its potential future functioning. Lastly, I think you raise a good question with respect to what does the four-year period mean. And I think the four-year period's a fine length of time as long as the model has validity. But if at the end of 2 years you discover for whatever reason that the model was flawed, I would not want us to wait 2 years further to start to deal with that. And I don't know how you build that in, but I've been spending a lot of my time recently doing habitat modeling for shorebird habitat renovation. And we have discovered that some areas in California that were modeled for this purpose, it didn't take long to discover that the birds were not as impressed with the model as the modelers were, and that's to be expected. That's the way things sometimes turn out. But you don't want to wait for the whole evaluation period if you see early on. So I think there needs to be some way to do response if the scenario is simply clearly off track, and I would want to find maybe what are the parameters that would tell us that, what are the things that we would be looking for, and then how would you respond under those circumstances, even though we don't think that they're going to come to pass.
Ms. Cox?
Lori, I think you summarized the salient points of the discussion, and I think I would just emphasize flexibility and the agreement for flexibility with PG&E, that if we get down the road, as Mr. Pumphrey was saying, that we agree that changes will be necessary, and this is a fluid process, it's an iterative process, and we may be surprised by data as we move forward.
I generally agree with everything the other board members have said. I just want, so in addition to making small adjustments along the way as they become apparent, I want to emphasize also that as USGS portions of their study come in, that those are triggers for reevaluating, you know, to see if what they are saying aligns with the assumptions made in the model and what PG&E is finding on the ground. So I would include those things as trigger points for review as well. I'm a little concerned about, I think that there is a balance to be made between making fine adjustments along the way and having a plan and running it for 4 years and seeing how it works. Because if you fiddle with things too much, you don't know what is causing the results that you're seeing. And so it sort of pollutes the science if you fiddle with it too much. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I just caution that to think about that as setting the right balance for these small adjustments and the range for these small adjustments, and letting things run for a significant amount of time that we can understand what the results mean as well. So,
okay, thank you.
Do you have your feedback?
I think so. And the one last thing that I know we didn't really discuss tonight, and maybe it's something we can talk about in November, is the time frame. People's idea of a time frame for this cleanup and abatement order. I think, obviously the Water Board has the authority to modify an order at any point. So even whatever gets adopted in 2015 can be changed, the next month or, 5 years later or 10 years later. I mean, there's always that ability to do that. I know in the past I've heard from the community, we don't even know what background chromium is, so we don't have a final cleanup number. And I would say that's true, and tonight's presentation was really focusing on the near term, 4 to 10 years, even out to 20 years, looking at achieving goals such as 80% mass removal, 50 parts per billion chrome, 10 parts per billion. I want the community and the board to know that none of that is set in stone in terms of a final. We don't have a final cleanup goal or limit, and at this point, I'm not recommending that we have that in this order, that these are all identified. I think Dr. Webster calls it interim remedial targets, but these are iterative, interim, with the notion that as we get information from the USGS or as the cleanup progresses, we can set more refined cleanup targets along the way. But if anyone has an idea in mind or an expectation that this cleanup order should cover 20 years or only 4 years, I mean, we write some permits, and that was part of the discussion of the 3 to 5 year window, is that like a federal permit gets renewed every 5 years. So there can be kind of a fixed recommendation that when those 4 year reports come in, the board picks up the cleanup order and makes a decision about whether to keep it in place or make changes to it. There can also be a sense that the order be in place for more like a 10 to 20 year time frame. Again, not saying that you can't go back in and amend it, but in terms of longer timeframes and reporting requirements that are actually set, like if we put a 4 year time frame in there, is it every 4 years for the next 24 years, or is it, what I'm saying? So just some things to think about, and any direction you have on that, and that could be, in a couple months too. But
does anybody want to respond to Ms. Kemper's question right at the moment? Mr. Pumphrey?
I would hope that we could craft a result oriented time frame as opposed to an arbitrary time figure, particularly because we know that there are some landmark events still to come, one of which is the background study. Another is the operation of the project in implementation of the order. So I would hope that you could sort of take a look at landmarks down the road that are foreseeable, and know that we're going to modify the order potentially at those landmarks and perhaps identify those. But I'd rather see us tie the duration of the project to the notion that it accomplishes what it's supposed to accomplish.
In that time frame, yeah, okay.
In whatever time
frame
is required.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay.
Well, and I know that there are other considerations so it's balancing what's effective in terms of enforcement goals, setting enforcement standards and goals, and for the cleanup, and if we set the cycle to be for the crank to be turned too rapidly, it's creating a lot of work for everybody with not much result. But if we turn the crank too slowly, then even though we might be modifying things that maybe there's because there's not the need to write a new permit or a new CAO order, that maybe we're not looking at things as closely as we should. So I mean, it feels to me like maybe in the early part of this cleanup order that we've turned the crank more quickly, and that as we gain more experience and more comfort with what's happening, that then we can turn the crank more slowly. So given what Mr. Pumphrey just said, I don't want to put a number on that, but that just sort of intuitively feels like maybe the right way to go. I don't know.
Yeah, and there's going to be more information coming in the next few years that we know for sure, and then, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, with that, do we need another break, or should we just go? I think we probably need to go right into item number 3, given the time. And that